Trejo versus Showman et al.
May it please the court. My name is Bob Kirshner. I represent Professor Leonard Trejo, who is the plaintiff appellant in this case. Dr. Trejo is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
On probation. Is that right?
Non-tenured, Your Honor. On a non-tenured.
In a probationary period?
No, Your Honor. He was on a non-tenured, he was on a tenure track, but he was not a tenured professor. Professor Trejo and others from the University of Illinois and across the country attended a conference in Toronto, Canada. The purpose of that conference was to discuss professional issues, including issues relating to sexual behavior and human sexual behavior. At this conference, there are seminars and presentations and poster sessions, and it is customary that following those poster sessions, individuals will gather at various places, including in the lounges and the restaurants, to discuss the events of the day, including their areas of academic interest. Professor Trejo did that, and he was accompanied by other professors, some tenured, some not, PhD graduate students who are attending the conference. And during the course of this discussion in the lounge area, there was a discussion about a program that was on TBS, on the NOVA series, dealing with the sexual behavior of non-human primates. All of the individuals seated around this table were participating in that discussion at various times. There were men, there were women, there were professors, there were graduate PhD students, some from the University of Illinois, some from other institutions. No one expressed any discomfort with the topic which was being discussed. No one got up and left. No one attempted to redirect the conversation or indicate that it was inappropriate in any way. Following that meeting, that convening, Professor Trejo and the gentleman that he was rooming with went upstairs to their room, and two of the women, PhD students, and by the way, none of these students were professors.
Are you referring to that they were convening in the bar room?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
None of the...
An unusual place to convene.
Well, it was customary to get together after the poster session and do things like that.
I know. Judges don't live in a vacuum, though.
After the conclusion of that discussion...
What's a poster session that preceded this?
I've never been to one, but as I understand it, a poster session, unlike a presentation where there may be a large group of people, there are individual presentations in various areas of the convention facilities at which individuals can present specific things that they have been working on. They can have one-on-one discussions.
There are actually posters.
And I think some have presentations there, but it's more of a one-on-one type of interaction following the main presentation. Two of the women involved, who were PhD students, accompanied my client and his roommate upstairs, and they played cards for a while. The Toronto conference ended, and Professor Trejo returned to his position as a faculty member, as a professor in the Department of Psychology, only to find out months later...
Did he make any unusual suggestions at that card game?
If the court is referring to a comment at the end of the... they were playing cards. At the end of playing cards, there was a comment about the women staying or not staying, getting naked, jumping in bed. And
that's what I'm talking about.
And the appellee refers to that in the brief. At the end of that conference, when the women returned to the University of Illinois months later, Professor Trejo becomes aware through a conversation with one of the defendants that two of the professors, Professor Fitzgerald and Miller, had made complaints about the behavior that they had heard of at that conference. What's remarkable...
Is there any document in the record that sort of like findings of fact by the administrator? I understand the recommendation he made that Trejo not be reappointed, and that was ultimately followed. But is there any... Did any of these administrative people ever create a written document, sort of findings of fact, or for this reason, or anything like that?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The closest that anything comes to that is in his notice of non-reappointment, he was advised that he was not going to be reappointed because of his behavior with graduate students, unprofessional conduct, and this decision was made by the department head, although the department head, and this is in the record, claims that this information was also presented to the executive committee for the department. The problem with that is the department head also admitted under oath that he had personally investigated this matter and obtained information which he never told Professor Trejo about, never gave him an opportunity to respond to. In fact, prior to ever talking with Professor Trejo, the department had said that he wanted to lead the lynch mob to get this person. He was going to throw him out of the department and used other profanities to describe what he was hearing from the two professors who had talked with the women from that conference. What's most remarkable about all of this is that there is a procedure at the University of Illinois for filing complaints of sexual harassment if any participant thought that that was sexually harassing conduct.
Let me get back to Judge Coffey's question on the card playing, and cited in the police brief. After playing cards in the plaintiff's room, plaintiff made a comment about the female graduate students getting naked. You say that's not correct?
It is a correct citation to the record. It is taken out of context, and that is this. They had engaged in hours of discussion together in this lounge area. They had gone upstairs and they were playing cards. In an offhand, comical way almost, he said, "You can either stay and we'll all get naked and jump in bed or play some more cards," something along those lines. If that in and of itself, or if that contributed in any way to the decision to terminate his employment relationship at the University of Illinois, we wouldn't have a free speech issue. But the free speech issue arises because that's not what they say caused the severance of his employment.
Was there any drinking down at the bar by any of these, or the plaintiff, his roommate, or any of the two female graduates?
All of them were drinking.
Were they drinking when they were playing cards, too?
That I do not know, Judge. I don't recall the record speaking directly to that.
If you leave out of it the statement of opinion at the bar, and just which was disposed of on a motion, and just look at the summary judgment record, would it be fair to say, or would you agree? Maybe you wouldn't, but would it be fair to say that this type of conduct, not only the remark about getting in bed or that, but also calling one of the girls at 2 a.m. and saying, giving somebody else's name and saying, "Come on over to a party," and so on. That type of conduct by a professor vis-a-vis female graduate students, that it would not be an arbitrary and capricious decision to say that that conduct was grounds for non-reappointment.
I would not agree that that would not be, under some context, including this one, that would not be an arbitrary or capricious decision.
Counsel, do you know that you're using up your rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor. I was trying to respond to the court's question.
I'm sorry.
In particular, Your Honor, because none of the students involved here, none of the women involved here, were his students. He had no relationship to them in any professional or other capacity. He had no control over their PhD program.
Well, I understand that's a fact, but as a matter of professional behavior, wouldn't this be a reasonable sort of decision?
Only if the court concludes that it is reasonable for a department head to regulate individually and personally by imposing his or her individual standards on off-campus, unrelated conduct to the professional obligations, and the tenure track position of a faculty member requires that that position be evaluated based on teaching, research, etc., Your Honor.
Do you mean that they cannot consider conduct of this nature? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
There are provisions at the University of Illinois for adjudicating and administering complaints of sexual harassment or other misconduct. None of those were followed here.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I represent the then provost of the University of Illinois, the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the head of the psychology department, two psychology professors, and three psychology grad students. As the district court noted, Dr. Chauvin, the head of the psychology department, made the decision to non-reappoint the assistant non-tenured probationary professor, the plaintiff in this case, because of unprofessional and untrustworthy conduct, because of a lack of professional judgment, and because of poor relations and interactions with grad students, and in particular female grad students.
If he had been a tenured professor, would the procedure operated the same? He would have been forced then to go to the sexual harassment mode, right?
Well, Your Honor, the person...
Let me put it another way. Wasn't it easier to go to deny tenure, or to take him, to fire him, in fact, or at least not re-up him for the next year, than it would be to go through the sexual harassment path?
You bet. It was, but that was not an administrative decision, Your Honor. There was a decision made by the female grad students involved to not invoke the sexual harassment procedure. The procedure in effect...
But I guess if that were the case, if he were tenured, that would have been the end of it.
Well, Your Honor, I can't speak to that. That hypothetical, I do not know, nor is there anything in the record which would lead me to know how Dr. Chauvin would have acted if the allegations had been made against a tenured professor.
But, I mean, we had the fact that they chose not to go with sexual harassment.
The students. Yes, Your Honor, that is true. The fact about the court's question, though, about the issue of how the university would have treated a tenured professor in a similar situation is actually extremely important to what occurred, which is the university, for lack of a better word, almost marries its tenured faculty, and there's an important evaluation period built into the university statutes, which is typically 6 to 7 years, and when an assistant professor is hired at the university, he is informed in writing, he receives notice that he serves at the pleasure of the Board of Trustees in 1 year increments with no right to any further appointment, and that's because when the university finally does make the decision to grant someone tenure, then all that tenure implies, it becomes a long-term relationship. This court has many times ruled that there is no property interest specifically in an assistant untenured professor at the University of Illinois' employment.
Do they provide for a hearing at any time during that period, say after 3 years or after 4 years?
Your Honor,
do the regs provide for it, is what I'm asking.
A hearing to evaluate their tenure?
And something like this, if he had been there for 3 to 4 years, no problems or anything else?
No. In fact, not of the hearing of the type that the appellant in this case attempts to evoke. In fact, the record is clear that no assistant professor candidate for tenure has ever been invited to.
All right. Does his contract of employment recite that?
Well, first he has no. First, Your Honor, he has no contract.
He has a year to year, doesn't he?
He has a year to year.
Is it set forth in there that he does not have any right to year? That's all I'm asking you.
What is set forth in there is it's silent as to the issue of whether or not he has a specific right to go to a hearing in that contract. It has been the Department of Psychology's procedure in the tenure context to have the discussions regarding tenure without the assistant professor present. With respect to the district court actually leapt over the issue of whether or not there was any entitlement, any constitutionally protected right to due process. There is no constitutionally protected right to due process in this case. He has
unless he showed a taking away of liberty.
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, going past the issue of property interest, the appellant in this case, Mr. Trejo, does argue that his occupational liberty interest was implicated. The problem with that is that the plaintiff, Mr. Trejo in this case, can't make any one of the three elements of an occupational liberty interest, let alone all three. To show the implication of an occupational liberty interest, the plaintiff must have been stigmatized. The plaintiff must have been stigmatized by public disclosure, and that stigma must be so broad-based that the plaintiff is essentially blacklisted, making it virtually impossible for him to be employed, for substantive due process to be implicated. First, what the plaintiff argues in this case was public disclosure was the university administration talking to his previous employer and witnesses from the conference who were not employed by the university regarding his behavior. Much like any employer would do in the context of evaluating an employee who may leave a probationary period. That's not the type of broad-based public disclosure that the court's jurisprudence has spoken to in substantive due process cases. There was no press release. There was no allegations published regarding his behavior at the Toronto conference. And in fact, that's the kind of the broad-based public disclosure that's necessary, because then the next element is that the stigma has to be so broad that he's blacklisted from his whole class of employment. In fact, there's nothing in the record, no attempt by the plaintiff, to show that he was blacklisted. He, in fact, testified under oath that while he was employed by NASA, after having left the U of I, he made no effort to seek a faculty position elsewhere. He left the U of I, became employed by NASA at a job paying much more money than he made from the University of Illinois. This is not the stuff of the substantive due process clause. But even if the district court was correct to simply leap over the issue of entitlement and go to due process, which it did because it was easy for the district court to find that even if he was entitled to due process, he got due process. He met with the decision maker three separate times. He was invited to meet with the decision maker, Dr. Chauvin, additional times after that, although he declined. He was allowed to submit any materials or any witnesses he wanted to the decision maker. The process Dr. Chauvin engaged in was he consulted with his own departmental advisory committee three times.
There's another issue, which in your time has expired, that I hope you will address, and that is the statement of opinion at the bar room conversation. I gather from reading the brief that somewhere there's a confession that had something to do, that statement of opinion had something to do with the decision not to reappoint him. And as I understand it, we have a rather, I would say, unfortunate situation. That particular whole matter was disposed of on motion to dismiss and therefore never got into the summary judgment half of the case. Then there's nothing, you know, I don't know, maybe you do have an idea, but I don't know whether these remarks that he made at the bar room are so ridiculous or so nonsensical that they can only be construed as a kind of a sexual come-on or harassment or something like that. There's nothing in the record to say that because of the fact that this was disposed of on motion. And if there wasn't, why isn't that a protected statement of opinion?
Well, Your Honor, in fact, while it wasn't discussed in the summary judgment, you're correct, because it had been disposed of on earlier motion. The matter is fully discussed in the underlying record because many of the depositions were actually taken in another case and so were taken prior to the time that the court determined the motion to dismiss. And so there actually is quite a bit of record, factual record, that's not discussed in the summary judgment motion in the record. There's two ways to answer your question. First is that it's impossible to pick apart Dr. Chauvin's decision regarding how he made that decision by little pieces. Ultimately,
well, that would be kind of a Mount Healthy issue. Would he have been fired anyway,
right, regardless
of whether they considered the remarks at the bar?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. In fact, we make that argument because what Dr. Chauvin especially focused on was what he believed to be untrustworthy conduct. And as the district court noted in its decision, the plaintiff's version of events regarding what he did that weekend shift throughout the record, especially the issue of the 2 o'clock at night call identifying himself.
Yeah, but that's got nothing to
do with
the counts which were dismissed. His claim was that he stated this opinion, kind of ridiculous or whatever, but he stated this opinion based upon this show that they had all watched, etc. And unless it can be demonstrated that itself was bad conduct, to state that under those circumstances, wasn't it erroneous to dismiss that complaint?
My time is up, but if I can answer your question, the answer to that is no. And the reason for that is twofold. One, it does not implicate the First Amendment because under Connick versus Myers,
Connick was a case where the person making the talk was criticizing his employer and that whole thing. And Connick says you've got to have it can't be just a personal grievance.
Right.
He's protected.
Right.
But that's got he was not criticizing the university.
No, he was not. But it's not an issue of public concern, Your Honor.
Why not?
It's not an issue of, you have to evaluate, as this court has said, context, form, place, content of what is said regarding whether or not this is public concern. And the district court looked at Swank versus Smart.
Yeah, and Swank, they were talking about a late night motorcycle ride of it with a young girl, and that's conduct
right, quite
different from stating an opinion in a barroom.
I would actually disagree, Your Honor. I think if you look at the context of what occurred with respect to the entire weekend, and you look at the content of his speech, he was essentially.
But you're dealing with a pleading, and this pleading alleges a statement of opinion,
which
nobody can say has had the effect of being a come on to the girls or anything else.
The content, Your Honor, even in the pleading, does not implicate an issue of public concern. Not in that context, not in that form.
I think Swank is entirely distinguishable
from
that.
Right. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.